slightly jet lagged, but I'm really, really excited. So those two things will combine and hopefully be fantastic. So I can barely see all of you except for the people who are on laptops. Actually, that's very helpful. So I'll be talking to you about ambient location and a bit about interfaces. So first off, my name is Amber Case. I started a company called GeoloQ, which merged with Esri last year. Esri is a big mapping company, and we're working on the future of location with them. But first off, could everyone hold up your phones really quickly? Great. Continue. Good. Just going to take a picture really quickly. Awesome. Thank you. So the faster you held those up, the more cyborg you are. All of you are cyborgs. Some of you are more reluctant cyborgs than others. It took you a little bit longer to fish those phones out of your pockets. And this guy, who I'll be talking about a little bit later, if any of you have heard of Steve Mann, can you raise your hand really quick? Great, not that many. Perfect. So we're all cyborgs, but you don't need to have some sort of implant. You definitely don't need to wear something on your face in order to be a cyborg. Anytime you interact with a piece of technology outside of yourself, you're really acting in this cyborgian fashion. The word cyborg came from a 1960 paper on space travel, and this is the actual definition, an organism to which exogenous components have been added for the purpose of adapting to new ambient spaces. And really, this was just talking about the idea that humans are very strange creatures, and they attach external appendages to themselves in order to be in places they shouldn't be, like space. But from the beginning of time, we've been in the symbiotic interaction, co-evolution with our technology. It hasn't been that our technology will take over us or will take over technology. We need technology to survive, and technology needs us in order to reproduce and survive as well. So if you look at the difference between the tools that we have today and the tools that we had in the past, there's been, from an early time, the physical extension of the self. So these physical extension, of a fist as a hammer, or the physical extension of a tooth as a knife. And if you, instead of breaking your tooth and having to grow a new one, which humans are not very good at, you can externally make a new tooth out, by making a knife. So it's much more extendable. But for a very long time, with the exception of writing and cave painting, we've definitely had these physical devices, and how they look and form and feel has been very stable for a few million years. A hammer still looks very much and acts very much like the same device that it was. It's basically stabilized in form and function. Whereas if you look at a mobile device or a computer, things change very quickly. Over the last 50 years, you wouldn't be able to recognize what this was and what it is today. Things are starting to melt and evaporate. The actual interfaces, the buttons that we had on our original mainframe computers have liquefied into a liquid crystal display, and now we can, through changing the software instead of the hardware and all the cables, change what that actually does. So we're kind of seeing this evaporation where now our devices are technically larger on the inside than on the outside. We're carrying around these kind of Mary Poppins devices where you can have anything show up in them and take anything into them without them getting any heavier. So the difference between these two things is that one is an extension of the physical self, and now we have these extensions of the mental self that are getting faster and faster and faster. So a traditional anthropologist goes to another country or another field site and looks at the anthropological other. They say, "Ah, how curious these people are. What about, look at their kinship, look at how their tools work," and then they write up a thing called thick description where lots and lots of data, sometimes thousands of pages. They bring this back to their home country and they tell everybody in the anthropological way about these people. But oftentimes it is ignored that we ourselves, in whatever country we're the native of, are our own strange species. We hold these little devices that, they cry and we have to pick them up and soothe them back to sleep. They need power at night, so we have to plug them and feed them. We have to take care of them or they break. We have to upgrade them or they make us look silly because they get old over time. And so we're in this curious relationship with these. So a cyborg anthropologist looks at the world around them and says, how weird and strange and curious we are, and look at these devices that we have with us. So that's how I got attracted to the field. It was started as a subsection of the anthropology of science in 1993. So we'll give you a little bit of history behind some of the wearable computing. So this is a portrait of this guy named Steve Mann in 1981. He would wear tens of pounds of equipment around MIT when he went there. And it took him about a year to convince somebody else to also wear this equipment to create a Borg collective, which isn't that much of a long time. He did everything via radio. So every time he went somewhere else to speak, for instance, he would have to climb up to the tallest building in the city, put a pirate radio antenna on top of it so he could get a signal. And he had basically wireless network access through radio. But the problem is that he had to get a signal. So he would wear a helmet, put metallic gel on his hair to conduct a signal through the helmet, and stick antenna out of the helmet. So he walked around as like a giant ant. You can actually see at the top left that there are antenna sticking out of his head. This was around this time when he was coating his hair with metallic gel. He met his future wife. I'll talk a little bit about that later. So one of the things that he really liked to do was when he was growing up, starting about age 10, he would walk down the street and there would be this television repair shop. And his father was in the textile industry near Toronto, Canada. And so he walked into the television repair store and he said, "I would like to get a job repairing televisions." And the owner of the store said, "Well, you know, I don't think so. You're 10 and I'm not hiring anyone right now." And Steve Mann came back every day, said, "I really, really want to work on televisions. Please let me do it." And the owner of the store said, "Why do you want to work on televisions?" And Steve Mann said, "Well, I want to take a television and make it so small that it can fit in my eye so I can see stuff that's going on in reality and then like block things out like billboards." And the guy thought that man was a little bit loopy and said, "Fine, I'll give you a test, and if you pass this test, you can work at the store." So he gave him this problem that he'd never been able to solve. And Steve Mann figures it out very quickly and fixes it, and the guy hires him. And this is Steve Mann's first step on this journey of tinkering with technology and making it smaller and smaller. So by this time in 1981, he had this heads-up display sticking into one of his eyes. And what he really wanted to do with it is not what we're seeing with Google Glass, where it's just basically, you know, you can get some text messages. He really wanted to take bits of reality away. Instead of having augmented reality, he wanted to have diminished reality. He and a guy named James Fung worked on a machine vision algorithm that would detect billboards, cancel them out, put a blank white box over them, and allow you to read text messages on top of them. So he was able to walk down the street and read, you know, whatever he was interested in reading, not see any advertising, and even better, when he walked into a store, cancel out any brands that he didn't like. So he would just walk into the store and only see the stuff that he wanted to buy. And he thought the idea of wearing something on your head was something for your own privacy and your own empowerment, and if somebody committed a crime, you could record it and actually, like, take care of yourself. So he got, I think, rear-ended by a car or something when he was walking, and he took a picture of the license plate, and the guy was captured, even though it was a hit and run. So this was part of his ideas, where he wanted to see better. This is an example of, this is a recreation of a first date that he had with his future wife, where they both wore cameras and heads-up displays, and they watched the date from the view of each other, from each other's perspective. You can now do this with Google Glass with a Hangout, which is just a really fascinating feeling of seeing yourself in third person. Here's an example of his real-life ad block. You can see there's an ad for L'Oreal, and he's reading his research paper on top of it instead. So he can walk down the street and do that. He also, I would mention that this system that he developed probably took about $500,000 worth of equipment to build, and so this is what he's wearing around all the time. And after a while, he's using it for very mundane situations. Like this is his wife Betty leaving him a message that says, "Hey, remember to pick up the milk," and that shows up in his vision over every supermarket sign. So until he gets the milk, he can't, you know, he won't cancel it out. And then he can say, "Okay, dismiss. I got the milk." Right, so you never forget. He also did not have very good memory of people's faces or their names, so he would just label them. So this is cashier 623. He's purchasing a lot of these giant batteries because he has to power all of the equipment that he's wearing all of the time, which he stored in a backpack initially and in a fanny pack later, which you'll see. But also people would walk up to him and he would have, you know, analytics on them, as in, I talked to this guy a year ago and his kids are now 4 and 6, so I can talk to him about, you know, this, and here's the last conversation that I had with them. So over time, this evolved, right? So he said, everybody said, well, why are you wearing 40 pounds of equipment? This is ridiculous. And he said, well, things change, and over time it'll get lighter and lighter. So as you can see, you know, maybe 40 pounds, 20 pounds, 10 pounds, by 95 it's 5 pounds, and then it looks pretty cool in 98. It's all in sunglasses here. In the right-hand corner, you can actually see that he's carrying something in his hand. And so the question is, you know, you could walk around with a heads-up display and just use it to consume stuff, which isn't fundamentally very interesting. What about during the times when you walk through a park and you have an epiphany, and then you get back to your computer and you have a blank screen and you don't know what to type? He was very interested in not having you conform to a computer, not like this all the time. He said, well, why do humans have to conform to a computer? Why can't a computer conform to us and allow us to be more human instead of less human, so that we're not on pause and scrunched down like this with bad posture, so that we're just in our environments? So the input was an issue, because what we've had for years, since the beginning of the mouse invented by Doug Engelbart as a stopover device, has been this, you know, external, this little external prosthetic thing that plugs into our machines. And the inventor of the mouse said, you know, this is just a temporary interaction device. The best way is to interact with data directly. But we didn't have that until we got touchscreen displays. So what happens if you're walking around? You know, you can't use a touchscreen, or you'll fall into something. I mean, you can watch people walk down the street with their phone and crash into things. So people started to, around the 70s and 80s, they started to make more alternative devices. The problem is that this is literally a persistent architecture. It's everyone buys the mouse. It's really hard for another entrant to get into the market. It's really hard for people to learn something else. And especially when people's alternative devices look like this, which is scary. This is like the, you know, the gargoyle type device, right? It works, but it's terrifying. So one of the only ones that survived is this thing called a twiddler. It's a one-handed keyboard. You play it kind of like a guitar, and you can chord information. So you kind of use it like this. People can get up to 60 or 70 or 80 words per minute with one hand. So you can walk down the street and type. So after a while, people were using this one-handed keyboard and a heads-up display and taking notes in Steve Mann's class. And then there's Thad Starner, who's working on the Google Glass project, and a bunch of people involved in this early wearable industry. And they were using it to be much more efficient and effective in their life. So this is actually from a research paper on it about how quickly people can learn to type on it. There's all these typing programs and things like that. So, you know, today, Steve Mann looks like this. This was the Borg group at MIT. Now, this is interesting anthropologically. You can see that there's two sets of people. There are the people with the short leather jackets, and over to the right, there's a divergent species. This is Thad Starner. He's part of the longer coat group. So that was kind of a splinter group, right? So he was equally as involved on this, and he ended up working at Georgia Tech. As you can see, his group is much more fashionable. They used completely different heads-up displays, as the private eye heads-up display. And sometimes, you know, these were used, the MyView goggles were hacked in half. I actually have one of these that works with a phone that I used to wear around and terrify people. But over time, this tribe of people got more and more usable, and eventually Thad Starner got hired by Google to work on Glass. And this means that even though this is very much a prototype, and yeah, it can't record for more than 5 minutes, and I'm not recording all of you right now, by the way, and when I walk around, I won't be recording all of you because there's 5 minutes of battery life, there needs to be an input. So hopefully next year we'll have a Bluetooth one-handed keyboard so you can actually write something when you're walking down the street and not run into people and fall over and get hit by a car. So we have this, and this is interesting. It's not augmented reality. You can't ad block with it. You can't get messages about a place on it. So it's very limited in its scope. But it's interesting, and I am wearing it because this is my job to wear and test these devices. So I gave you a little bit of history, and now I'll tell you a little bit about the future, which really just means going back in time again. When somebody, you know, when people talk about the future not being evenly distributed, it definitely was not evenly distributed in the 70s, where at Park Research, at a division of Xerox, there was a guy named Mark Weiser, and he came up with a term. He was also the father of ubiquitous computing. He came up with a term called calm technology. And the idea of calm technology is literally that it's calm. A lot of the technology in the past has not been good at humans. Whenever you get angry at technology, it's not that it's your problem, it's technology's problem. It's not been designed well, it's not been designed for you, it's not been designed to make you a superhuman or make you happy or extend who you are as a human. It's just been designed to be technology. Some technology, because people get excited about it, is just technology for technology's sake, which is completely useless and angering, and it takes up so many millions of dollars. So the idea behind calm technology is it's there when you need it, and it's not when you don't. So you're not dealing with tons and tons of menus. You're not having things pop up all over the place. It's just there to help amplify your life. So your actions can be buttons. There's an invisible interface, and I'll get more into this. And you know, you can have some sort of trigger-based interaction. So a prime example of calm technology is the Momoto. So the ironic thing about the Momoto, which is made by a group out of Sweden, is that I gave a speech on calm technology a few years ago in Sweden, and this guy from the audience, Martin Kallström, came up and said, hey, I'm really excited and inspired to build this Momoto device. And I said, great, you know, I want to try it out. So this is something that persistently records everything. It takes pictures. And so you can see over time your entire life, but and see what you've done over time. But because you're recording constantly and it's not on your face, it's not scary. You know, Google Glass doesn't record persistently, but everybody thinks it does. This is something that records persistently, but the way in which it was designed is it's designed to be a piece of calm technology. First off, the camera itself is off to the side. It doesn't really look like a camera. You wear it here, you don't wear it up here. So, you know, if you're turned away from somebody, you're not going to be taking pictures of them. So the design has completely... The design completely counts on things like this. Google Glass is still pretty scary and weird, but this is calm, and so it's different. Other parts of calm technology is that, you know, you are abstracting all the complexity away for the user that's necessary to abstract away, while also leaving people in control. So you have these processes that kind of occur in the background, and then data can be pushed to somebody. And the input can come in many forms, you know, like your location or time of day or your speed or average speed over time. And so people started to try and do something like this a long time ago. The most recent one that I found was this paper on location-based reminders. So for a while, these feature phones had some GPS in them, just a little bit of data, really expensive. You couldn't download apps very easily. And people weren't really using this. So this one woman worked with a team, and they created this location-based reminder system. So you go to the store, and it automatically sends you a message, hey, remember the milk. It sounds fantastic. This stuff has been around since the 90s and 80s, costing millions of dollars to set up and to use. And this was put into a newspaper article. It was, hey, everybody hated it. They were like, why are we using research money to get location-based reminders? This doesn't make any sense. And so I was reading this article in around this time. I was like, oh my gosh, well, I really have just been ranting about the idea that information should come to you based on location or something interesting that could empower you. You know, your devices and your interfaces should make you into superhumans. So I kind of took a different approach. I said, well, what happens if you start to make something that was formerly invisible visible? And I met somebody named Aaron Parecki, who I later started this little side project with called GeoLoki. And so what he was doing is making the invisible visible. He was taking his location at 5-second intervals and for about 2 years at that time. And he was making these little maps based on speed. So you can actually see this is a map of Portland of everywhere that Aaron has been. The red is him going very fast. The green is going medium fast, and the dark purple is him going really slow. And as you can see on the top left-hand corner, it's him driving around in a crowded area of town looking for parking. And you can see his speed going really slow. So when I found that he was doing this, I got extremely excited. I said, oh my gosh, you can do all these amazing things. And sure enough, he was doing all these amazing things with the data. Because at this point, I had been researching, especially for my thesis, what's the future of the interface? And there are many futures of the interface, and you'll hear a lot about that today. But I was thinking more of there were solid buttons, and then there were liquid buttons, and what if the next button is in the air, right? So what if you could just draw an invisible radius on this map, and when you get into it, something happens, right? And this idea of this invisible button was very intriguing to me. So you go somewhere and ding, something happens. Anything can happen. And so this sounded like a great idea, but there were all these problems like battery drain. You can't have your phone always asking where it is because first off, there's privacy implications, and second off, battery drain is just a massive issue. So I said, well, if we solve some of those problems, we made this sort of thing empowering instead of creepy, and we made some algorithms to reduce battery drain, then we could open up this whole market and we could bring to life Mark Weiser's vision from Park Research in the 1970s. And it was this fun little side project that we started working on. And so we made this little thing called GeoLoki, and we said location should empower people, and your phone should be a remote control for reality, and this should be, how you work. And we started telling people this, and they were like, interesting. And so we just started building stuff. We said, well, if we don't know how to explain it, let's just build. So one of the things we built was this thing called GeoNotes. So there was a map, aaron.pk/map or caseorganic.com/map, and it was just a blank map, and there's this little Geiger counter on it, which was whether Aaron and I were likely to be in a certain location. So it didn't give away any of our personal details. And then you could leave a message. And so I just opened up my map and I said, anybody can leave a message on this map and draw a little radius and put a message in it anywhere around Portland. So I started getting hundreds of messages where the messages were interesting. They weren't ads. The default is always to say, oh, let's put some ads on a map and then you'll get location-based ads. And I always ask people, I said, well, do you really want to receive location-based ads? And they're like, no. And I said, well, why would you make that for somebody else? And they say, oh, because ads are where all the money is. It's like, well, I would beg to differ because it's where some temporary money is, but the real value is actually like empowering people and giving them interesting information. So the information I started to get was I'd go over the bridge and I'd get a message about how old the bridge was and how many people went across it every day. Or I'd be walking down the street and I'd get a message that said, there's a blackberry bush over here. You should go pick blackberries. So I'd go and like eat a bunch of blackberries. It was all these like very small, very serendipitous things. Or I'd stop in an intersection and be like, hey, our class is adding messages to your map right now. And or somebody would be like, hey, if you're ever in the area, come to my office. Here's the key code. If you're here between this and this hour, just stop in. And so, I go stop in and meet people that I wouldn't normally meet. And so there were all these kind of ambient notifications. And so we started hooking this up to all sorts of different things. We had these little X10 controllers that we plugged into the wall, and we made it so that when we got home, we'd enter the radius that said home, and the lights would automatically turn on, and when we leave, the lights would turn off, and then we hooked up all these computer voices to it where it would say, welcome home, you haven't been here in this many hours. and then we hooked other people into the system so that when they visited our house, it would say their name and say hello, which terrified them. We found this hyperlocal weather database, which literally within 6 or 7 blocks, it would tell you the micro weather trends. And as we bike a lot in Portland, we found this very useful. So we hooked this in to the GeoLoki platform, and we'd open up the app, and then we just forget about it. And we get these little notifications like it's going to start raining in 10 minutes. And it's going to rain for 20 minutes, and then it's going to stop. And the first time we got one of these messages, which was specifically around the 6 blocks that we were in, we kind of looked and we're like, well, it's completely sunny out. This is ridiculous, and this doesn't work. And lo and behold, 10 minutes, this giant dark cloud shows up, rains for 20 minutes exactly, and stops. And we were with a client, we were eating some dinner, and I got the notification on my phone. I said, well, we can't leave for another 10 minutes because it's going to be a giant downpour, but it'll only last for 5 minutes, don't worry. And he said, well, what is this? And I said, oh, we're just using our software, let's see if it works. And sure enough, he's like, well, I'm just going to go. And so he starts walking outside, and We're like, don't worry, 5 minutes, and it stops. So this was tremendously empowering, you know. We knew when to bike home. We knew when something bad was going to happen. It was just fantastic. And, you know, you can imagine, like, a car dealership using this and be like, hey, it's going to hail, so we should probably put the cars under wraps for, you know, a little while so that we don't get hail damage. And so then we started plugging in all sorts of real-time data into it. So if you stop at a bus stop and there's no message, you know, about when the next bus is going to arrive, we hooked into the real-time bus data, and we started, you know, when we wait for the bus, get a notification, the next bus will be here in this many minutes, and you can see it in real time, and you didn't have to text anything or anything like that. And then we had to test it. So the problem is that GPS chips are different on all the different devices, and we were doing this as a side project, and to get the 20 different devices we needed, it would have been like $2,000 or $3,000. So we initially got them all from a store. We went to a phone store and we got $2,000 or $3,000 worth of devices, tested them for a month, and then returned them and got all of the money back. And we're like, well, how many phone places are there in town and when will they catch on? Because we can't just keep doing this. So he said, wouldn't it be great if we could get everybody off their computers and all of our friends to come over with their different devices and just walk around and test for a while? He said, well, we could probably give them beer and then we could have that once or twice, but then people aren't going to run around, you know, miles at a time with beer. So we said, what if we just made a homage to the idea of Pac-Manhattan created by Dennis Crowley? So let's just make a real world Pac-Man / Risk game, and we called it Map Attack. So we literally just put all these little tiny GPS fences with numbers in them all over the map. And some of them were 50 pointers, and some of them were 10, some of them were, you know, 20. And you'd open up your phone with this Map Attack game, it would assign you a red or blue team, and then you just try to get as much territory as you could by physically going to that little GPS circle and running through it and then watching it turn color. It turns out that this was this hadn't been done yet, real time, having 20 people in a game, having everybody's device subscribe to the latest state of the game, and being able to watch everyone in real life on a phone capture these pieces of territory. That was ridiculous. And we built it over a series of like 2 or 3 hackathon type weekends, and it worked. And so I invited everybody over to our house, and I said, hey, we're just going to run around and play a game of Pac-Man. And we debuted it at Stanford University during a geography conference. So what happened was immediately 2 kids ran with the phone and won and got all the points. other people started running around, and we got our 20 test devices for hours and hours, and we got to test all the devices for free in the game. So that worked out really well. And we also ended up running all over campus, which was really exciting because we all wanted to tour it, but the internet was so sticky that we didn't want to ever get up from our chairs and stop working. So one of the things that happened was there was this guy that got stuck on this map, and I could see him at the bottom of the map, and it had been like 15 or 20 minutes after everybody came back. And I started to worry. Where is this guy? You know, is he okay? Did he get stuck just over at the bottom part of the map? And he finally comes back, and I said, what happened? You know, are you okay? And he said, yeah, well, you put a 50 pointer in a construction zone, and and I couldn't get to it. And I said, well, it looks like you got it on the map, you know, because I had drawn this on, like, I had made the map before I ever visited Stanford, and, you know, on the map view, it looked like everything was fine, and it turns out there's lots of construction, so I had no excuse, you know. And so I said, well, what happened? How'd you get it? He said, well, I walked up to the construction zone, and I couldn't get in, so I asked one of the construction workers, hey, can you just take my phone and put it in the middle of the site, and then wait till it says 50 points. And the construction worker looks at him quizzically and says, yeah, sure, I'll do that. So he takes his phone and, hey, 50 points, what are you doing? Like, why did you have me do this? Well, we're playing this game, da-da-da, it's really exciting. You run around, you get all these points. And the construction worker looks at him and he says, you know, in the 15 years that I've worked at Stanford, no one has ever come up to me and talked to me. They've all just been in their phones. And they haven't looked up and they haven't done anything. And finally, you know, after all these years, you're the first person that has come up and talked to me. And so they had this philosophical discussion about, like, whether technology was good or not. He comes back really late, and that's what he was doing. And we all realized the next morning that we were completely sore, because when you think about it, you know, kids' games are very simple. You have, like, a bunch of 5-year-olds on a block, and they make up a game. Hey, it's going to be like this, and then you do this, and then, okay, run. And then 3 or 4 miles later, you know, somebody calls them back for dinner, and they're exhausted, and they've exercised every muscle in their body. Because there's this game that exists in their imagination. And I thought it was really, really important to make something like that for adults, because adults' brains don't necessarily have that imagination. And if you can have a third-party device or game that does that and get everybody out there instead of stuck in front of their computers, then it's very interesting. So we made that game. We're going to remake it again for newer phones because it doesn't work as well anymore on old devices. So that was that. And then we started looking at more static content. And I realized that you can go onto Wikipedia and find a bunch of really interesting stuff, but fundamentally, if you're finding stuff about a location, you have to be there, you have to go visit. And so either you're taking that and then putting it on a map and making a custom map and then going and on this tour, but there's no way to get it serendipitously. And so I thought that it was a very strange issue. You know, we're so advanced, but all the stuff is on the web, a lot of it's not on mobile, and none of it's associated with your location. So we started taking location-based data sets, like all the pinball machines in Portland, and we put them into an app and had a little pinball ding that would show up when you were near a pinball machine. And it would tell you, here's the name of the bar, here's the pinball machines in it. And we went to test it on a bar crawl, where we just walked down the street until we heard a ding, went to the bar, played pinball, went to the next bar. And it was amazing. It was this different way of experiencing reality, where you weren't in your phone looking on Yelp, trying to plan for a perfect form of the future with the perfect ratings and so that everything was okay. You were just walking around and then you got these dings and you did something. And then we found out that there was all this interesting information on Wikipedia that had GPS coordinates. And so we threw all of that in the entire world into the system and started playing with that. So I had been in Portland for 8 years. And I never knew about half of the architecture. I'd walk down the street and suddenly I'd get information about this particular place that I'd never been before. Or the world's smallest park, which literally this is the world's smallest park. It's in a tiny intersection in Portland and I had walked by it every single day and I didn't know it was there. And so I get this ding, it says world's smallest park. I'm like, where is this thing, And I walk through the intersection, there it is. It even has its own tree trimmer, gardener, maintainer guy who. It's the easiest job in the world, right? So I just started getting all of these, and so we found the serendipitous information was really fantastic. And so we had just been building the stuff on our own platform, and then we said, well, let's have other people use it. So we opened it up and made some hackathons, and one of our friends made this app called Don't Eat That, which took all of the restaurant inspection scores in Portland, and if they were very bad, would tell you, don't eat there, that's a bad inspection score. It only got 20 on the inspection score. So after we did all of this, and we got bought by this larger company, and now we're doing larger things, we started to think of all the other pieces of data. You might have location, and that's interesting, but that's only one piece of the equation. And then we, kind of got into this kind of quantified self state where one of my friends was saying, there's all these new technologies. A lot of them are social networking. I already have plenty of friends. I already have a wife. This isn't, there's all these new technologies for friendship or dating. I have all these friends. But at the end of it all, I don't know much about myself. And he was like, I really want to have this kind of cybernetic feedback loop to understand more. And so there's all these different data sets out there. There's all these different proprietary technology. There's like the Up and there's the Nike Plus and there's all these different things. And they don't talk to each other. And the whole point of the future of the web, especially from somebody like Mark Weiser, was that you have all this stuff correlated with each other. It's not written in different languages. There's not different protocols. There's some way to connect them all together. Because you might know that you didn't sleep that much, but do you know why you didn't sleep that much? Maybe it was something that you ate. Maybe you haven't exercised in like 20 days, and maybe you're going to get sick. So it's all these different data sets that correlate together and have meaning, and so far it hasn't really been that way. And so we're kind of having this Tower of Babel where we want to build up this great understanding, and everything's just kind of fragmented and proprietary. And so we have now more and more frictionless data gathering, but we don't have the correlation. And so that's something in the future. I started doing all these little experiments where I would take my floor plan and put it into The Sims and run it and see over time what I would do as a person. And yes, I forget, the bills or, I would walk in and there'd be a chair in the way and that would actually lead to me getting angry. But there was the only way to see it was to look at it from above over a longer period of time and to make what was formerly invisible visible. And so I started kind of debugging my life, which I called a programmatic approach to perfect happiness, through looking at this feedback loop of The Sims. You know, oh, well, that chair is in the wrong place and that makes me angry, which is incredible to think that a simple chair could make me angry. So I'll move the chair in the game and I'm happy and I'm up to the self-actualization level. Well, let's move the chair in real life and see what happens. Oh, I feel better when I get home from work, but I don't know why. It must be that chair. Interesting. So, you know, there's two parts to it. You know, I would say that the best technology is invisible in that it can get out of the way and let you live your life and amplify your humanness. But on the other hand, taking what was formerly invisible and bringing it to life so that you can see it over a longer period of time can allow you to understand why you're unhappy or understand who you are a little bit more. I did this other thing called the Harvard Happiness Project, which every 15 minutes or so, three times a day, I would get this text message that said, hey, here's a questionnaire. And it was a 15-minute questionnaire. It took so long. I had to do it for 3 months. It was, who are you with? Where are you? Are you eating? What are you doing? You know, are you happy? Are you sad? I filled out this thing tediously for 3 months. And at the end of the 3 months, I got these amazing graphs back, which was, when you're at work, you're completely depressed and you hate life. And I was working at this company who, you know, whenever somebody asked me, how's your job? I said, I love it. It's the best place I've ever worked. But when I was at work, I was reporting to this application that I was depressed and I hated it. So there was this lie. I was lying to everybody and myself that I liked my job. And then every time every time I was working on this GeoIQ project, I was on top of the world. It was the best thing ever. I had 100% happiness. And so I said, what if I just quit my job according to this data? And so I called up my boss and I said, you know, I need to quit. He said, well, I thought you were going to quit like 3 months ago. You know, maybe I can invest in your new company. The last guy who left this office started Stack Overflow. So, you know, I missed out on that. He said, why didn't you tell me this? I would have quit 3 months ago. And he said, well, I was waiting for you to quit. I didn't want to call you up and be like, hey, you gonna quit yet? You know? So I quit and I did the happiness thing again. Of course, I was super happy. So the whole sort of life editing that you get from that is very interesting. And as that happens more and more, it's about taking that kind of like cybernetic feedback loop and optimizing your happiness and seeing the patterns that you slip into as a human. So to conclude, I would say that, you know, the best interfaces and the best technology being invisible and lightweight, you know, we no longer have this, but we have this instead. This is a bunch of people getting 50 points in the map attack game in an alleyway. So with that, thank you very much, and I hope you have a great rest of the conference.